This episode of Fermented Adventure the Podcast is sponsored by Brewskits, handcrafted dog treats made from spent beer grains, oats, barley, and rye. No chemical preservatives, a great source of fiber, and packed with protein. Visit brewskits.com to see the full selection of treats for your dog and your cat. Receive 15% off, no minimum purchase, on your first order by typing in lowercase FA2024 at checkout. Cheers! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, craft spirit enthusiasts, and those interested in the intoxicating world of craft distilleries, cideries, meaderies, wineries, and the occasional foray into breweries. It's Rich Shane, and welcome to Fermented Adventure, the podcast, where we bring you the fascinating people that are making the mash, fermenting, distilling, bottling, pouring, and delivering to you some of the finest libations in the world. Before we get started, here are a few housekeeping items. Thank you for bringing the podcast into wherever you are and whatever you're doing. We truly are grateful that you have chosen to listen and make us part of your day. It would mean the world to us if you left a 5-star review. This helps us climb in the rankings, and it makes it easier for others to find us. Don't hesitate to leave us your comments as well. If the podcast didn't meet your expectations, tell us why. We're always striving to improve. You can find us at fermentedadventure.com. We are on Instagram and Facebook as Fermented Adventure. Email us at fermentedadventure@gmail.com. All right, FA Nation, let's meet our guests. She's Laura Fields. I'm Rich Shane. This is Fermented Adventure, the podcast. Laura, welcome back for another episode of Whiskey Tangents.
I feel welcome. Thank you.
You're always welcome. You are our most reoccurring guest because you have a segment on here anytime you want to show up. We're going to talk rye whiskey. We're going to talk your trip to Scotland. We're going to talk a little bit about the book you're working on, American Whiskey History. This is a tangent. We never know where we're going to end up, right?
Right.
So let's start with, let you've been in Scotland for a while. Let's start with this. So I sent you some samples. You don't know what they are.
No.
Number one, what do you think it is?
That's quite nice.
I figure we'll start this off with a little bit of a tasting, and I'll give you some time. Maybe give me your opinions and your thoughts. It's quite nice. Mm-hmm. I know you've consumed a lot of scotch over the last week or so, and you brought back at least one bottle that you've made me aware of. You know, what are your thoughts about that? Or tell me about or share your experiences in Scotland.
Oh, I was smart, actually. I bought my whiskey in advance in London. And when I flew over there, I had some bottles ready for me at the Whiskey Exchange, I believe it was, which was right around the corner from my hotel. It was awesome. I stayed in this beautiful hotel in London and basically just walked around the street to go pick up my whiskey. And they're so knowledgeable there. You know, you could just ask them, well, this is my palate. This is what I'm interested in. What do you got for me? And so he pointed out a bunch of bottles and I ended up leaving that place with like Armagnac. And what did I get? I got some Longmorn and an old Seagram's bottle with 25-year-old Seagram's. Like really cool bottle. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I got a, what was it? A 15-year-old, Glenlivet that was, but it's like dark. It's dark brown. I have to pull it out. I forget what the,
I know you're looking all over your bottle shop there and your,
oh,
your,
I have
your
so
library.
Many down. It's ridiculous. But most of the whiskey I just bought is kind of shoved on my top shelf over there. So I've got, the door is closed, so I can't really see it. It's like kind of shady glass, but I can kind of glimpse it. But I went to Glen Kinchy, picked up a few bottles there. I got a Glen Turret. I got, some Glen Scotia. So good. I had this one experience where the hell was I? In Edinburgh. There's a, Cuban cigar bar where it was amazing because I was there by myself and I was so spoiled. I got the cigar I've always wanted to smoke my whole life, a Cohiba Lancero, and they had them there and they were ridiculously expensive and I didn't care. I was just like, give me that. And then I had a Glen Scotia 25 and I melted into my chair. It was just amazing. And then I had a Glenturk 15, and I had like several. And then the guy, of course, who was helping me, like, fell in love and was like, oh, you're so wonderful. I love that you love this stuff. And so he's like, let me get some of the bottles that I have that I want to have you taste. And I was like, yes, please. So I was terribly spoiled. It was wonderful.
It's like a Pennsylvania rye and farming aficionado gets to see Scotland for the first time.
Oh, it
And
was beyond. Yeah.
yeah, but it's, you have such a rich understanding and knowledge of history. What was or what are some of the takeaways that you had from seeing the distillation processes, the setups of distilleries? There's some that you went to, as you mentioned. What kind of stood out to you there?
I don't even know where to start with that question. Everything. First of all, it's insanely green there. I mean, I take for granted I live in Bucks County and everything's beautiful and green and lush. But nothing like there. Oh my God, sheep everywhere. Because I was in Edinburgh, like in right where the lowland meets the highlands, basically right in the middle belt of the country. There's so much pasture land and sheep, and like cashmere is their big export there. So I was just like, ugh. A lot of knitted things, kilts and whatnot, lots of pasture land. It struck me too that the farming community, the country's ancient. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like in Pennsylvania, we struggle to keep 5 acres of land from being turned into Toll Brothers housing. But there is this genuine deep respect for farmland. I'm sure that has something to do with the feudal system, maintaining the lands and things like that. But it's gorgeous to just leave the city and go for a drive and be immersed in the countryside almost immediately, when you leave Edinburgh. And it's just stunning. And the shrubbery that borders all the properties and the, expansive grass and cheap. I think I saw one coo the whole time I was there. Those big furry brown cows with the horns. They're all over Scottish advertising. Not familiar?
Okay. No, I
Anyway, there's
mean, I'm sure if
amazing
I look at
cows.
Scottish advertising, yeah, I would
Highland
recognize it right
cows.
away. Okay.
Highland
Oh,
coos.
I it's funny because you say that, and I've been scrolling Instagram now, and maybe because I like all your stuff, it's showing me an opportunity where I can own my own Highland cow, and
Yes.
I don't even know where the heck that came from.
Well, buy a cow today.
Okay.
There's so, and then the number of different variations in the sheep. So it's not just like monoculture or anything like that. There's lots of variation in the countryside, and depending on whether you go east or west from Edinburgh, not that there's very far to go east, but still, Glenkinchie's off to the east, and I got to go to that distillery. But I was there specifically to see distilleries that had familiar connections to Pennsylvania rye, because I was trying to kind of understand, with the Scots-Irish coming over and settling in Pennsylvania and really having a huge impact on the distilling tradition here in Pennsylvania. I wanted to see, because I had always known through my research there were a lot of parallels between the two. So I wanted to see for myself what those parallels actually were. And so I knew that Pennsylvania rye distilleries before Prohibition had large worms. So I went to Glenkinchie specifically to see their worm, which, of course, the tour guide was shocked. Like, why do you care about our worm? Nobody really asks about it. And I was just like, well, I want to know about it because I'm just stunned by them. I think they're fascinating ways to condense spirit, and I wanted to see it for myself. Of course, it's behind a wall and it's inside this giant iron tank, so you can't really see it without going up to this catwalk. And shh, don't tell anybody I did that. But absolutely amazing, everything about
Thousands
that
of
place.
people visit this distillery every year,
And nobody cares.
and you're like, I need to see the worm.
Right.
They're like,
Right.
I'm sorry, Mexico is south of you if you want to see a worm. That's where
Yeah,
maybe they
right.
thought there was a little misunderstanding.
Oh, I totally learned too that whatum, because they don't say worm. I'm terrible with accents, so forgive me. But the whatum means snake in Old English. So the translation was actually snake, not worm. And I always associate it with the little squiggly worm, but really it's snake. So I learned that. That was fun. And they have, like, right when you walk into Glenkinchie, they have an old, I don't know if it's like a 100-gallon, 150-gallon copper pot still that has the worm tub. That's actually a small wooden worm tub, and it's a round coil. But at Glenkinchie, they actually have essentially the worm is coiled in a rounded rectangle. So it doesn't curl the way that we envision moonshiner stills that spiral down. It's actually like a rectangle as it makes its way down, which I thought was fascinating, but it made sense because that's the space they had at the distillery, this long rectangular space. So they just made it work. And I don't see why that would affect the spirit at all to have it be a different shape. You know, it does the same thing. So I don't know. I was just in awe of it. And I don't know. What else can I tell you? You asked me about farming.
Well, it's interesting because what becomes top of mind from there is I saw that you had a little dialogue with Royce Neely. And obviously, he does part of that worm that you spoke about, the Woodham, if I can say that correctly, that's exposed as well. So it's funny how what you experience, because I would say I don't recall any distillery other than theirs that I've ever seen that exposed like that. And
right.
But it becomes top of mind, right? It becomes part of the conversation that it's almost like that reticular activator thing. And I've had not enough to drink, so I can say that out loud. You see that, and then you see something here in the United States that is being done, and you're like, oh, I have a better understanding as to why that is. So I saw that dialogue, and that's the connection of the history and the that you bring about and that you talk about and you shine a light on for American whiskey history. Now you go back to Scotland, or you go to Scotland to mm-hmm. get a better idea, right? This is where it's starting. A lot mm-hmm. of what we do today was brought over, and this is the resource as to why. And you get sure. that knowledge. You get that knowledge deeper to what you have.
Well, also the beauty of seeing what Pennsylvania rye might look like today if it hadn't been eradicated, that Scotch whiskey production has changed, but not so drastically that they've lost their connection to tradition. And I feel like if Pennsylvania rye had still existed today, it would somewhat parallel what's going on in Scotland. Those changes that have taken place obviously are still there. They have, you know, a different governance on how whiskey is made there. But you can see the similarities. Like barley and rye are very flavorful grains and contribute a great deal to the distillate made from them. And Pennsylvania rye, in many cases, was 100% rye. Rye and rye malt, obviously. And barley, all barley malt, really, in Scotch. There were Monongahela ryes that were made from 100% rye malt, you know? So it'd be interesting. For me, it was just kind of like I was replacing barley with rye and just watching how it all would have taken place. And the setups and the distilleries, my God, the similarities to things like Broadford. I put up a post on the American Whiskey History page the other day where I showed a picture of the inside of the ruins of Broadford in Pennsylvania, which is the old distillery where Old Overholt used to be made. And all that's left in that building are, you know, these steel rings, you know, halfway between the floor and the ceiling in the fermentation rooms, this giant warehouse. And essentially, it's only a one-floor building. There's no real division of the floor other than these rings in the ceiling. And they look odd to a person that's not familiar with what that is. But in Scotland, they have those same rings that the fermentation vats fit into. And I knew that that was the case from my research, obviously. But to see it in person and to go, man, now I can completely envision how that worked. That those vats just sat right on the ground that the tourists and I were standing on, you would never have been on the ground floor. You only would have been on the second floor because that's the only place you have access to the doors on the fermentation tanks and to, you know, any stirring apparatus that was up there if it needed to be fixed. You'd never be down on the first floor, you know? So it was amazing to actually stand on that catwalk and peer into these wooden vats, which is what it would have been, you know, these giant wooden vats. And here it is, still working, still making whiskey in large quantities, still using fresh yeast, by the way. They never abandoned the use of fresh yeast at these distilleries. So there's these giant tanks. And I've been told on numerous occasions here in America that using fresh yeast is just too difficult. It's too expensive. It requires too much work, yada, yada. But here, Scotland is, having modernized the tanks that they use and the processes that they use, that there is no yeast master anymore. It's actually the distilling staff that maintains the yeast. And it's not nearly as difficult as it used to be. We've come a long way in 50 years, you know? Like, it could be done, America. We could still use fresh yeast. We could still vastly affect the flavor of the whiskeys that are being made here if we went back to fresh yeast, in my opinion. Lord knows the Scots won't give it up. God bless them.
Well, it's an interesting commentary because, look, Pennsylvania, as we discussed before hitting record, you know, Pennsylvania is still in its infancy state in terms of its whiskey, its rye, its bourbon, all those things. And it's growing. It's getting better. Look, we did an episode featuring and highlighting Eight Oaks Distillery, their Veterans Cut, which I think, and I've said this, this is one of those products that I would say one of those products have been produced that I'm starting to put up and say, you know what? Those Pennsylvania distilleries have arrived and they're getting there to the point where you can. It's almost like I would say when they did that whole, you know, Napa Valley and Sonoma goes to
competition.
France.
Yes.
And they're blind and you have no idea. And right. I think that that's where if you were to blind taste somebody, like maybe Fred Minnick, I don't know, Lou Bryson. I mean, you start to put these names out there, blind taste them and mm-hmm. not let them know where any of these spirits are coming from.
Right.
Some of these products, and look, it's not, we talk Pennsylvania because we live here. But the truth of the matter is, we're also talking Texas. We're also talking Indiana. We're also talking Ohio. We're also talking Minnesota. We're also talking California.
New York.
I mean, right. I don't want to leave New York and I don't want to leave Maryland out. But the reality of it is these producers now are elevating their craft to the point that somebody comes along and says, you know what? We're going to do fresh yeast. That's going to be our little niche. That's what's going to set us apart because, as you said, nobody's telling them they can do that or they shouldn't do that. Maybe that's a thing now.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I wrote today about how one of the interesting characteristics of Scotch whiskey is they don't necessarily have a mash bill per se, the way that we do here in America, but they do have a recipe of ratios, percentages of flour versus grist versus the husk of the grain. They obviously include the husk because they use that in the lautering process, the filtration process. But the amount of grist and the amount of flour that they use in those ratios very much affects the flavor of the whiskey. So it's not like in America, you know, we chuck the grain in. I don't mean to belittle it, but, you know, we put the grain into the mill, usually a hammer mill, the smaller distilleries, and grind it up. And when you do catch it in your hands after it's been ground, there's quite a variation of texture there. You know, you've got more grit and then you have a little bit more flour, but they're not separated from one another. Where in Scotland, they actually do that. They separate the three ingredients and use that to create their mash. So it'll be, 15 or 20% flour, depending on how, you know, biscuity or cereal-like they want the character of the flavor to be. And then the balance is the grist, that more cornmeal-y kind of texture. Now, we don't do that in America. How cool would it be to have an American distiller do something like that with rye, say, where they're grinding up a little bit of the rye into flour? I know one distillery, it was a Bluebird distillery in Phoenixville. They do a very fine flour. Jared has always said, you know, that's the way I like it. That's the way I do it. If you go to McLaughlin Distillery outside of Pittsburgh and Swickley, he does a very coarse grind. It's almost like a crack with his corn. And that shocked me how much oily characteristic that creates in his whiskey. So those are two ends of the spectrum. I love both of those whiskeys. It'd be interesting to see a combination of the two and see how that would turn out. One is obviously Bluebird makes a lot of different whiskeys and McLaughlin only makes bourbon and corn whiskeys, but he's coming around. I'm talking him into making rye. I'd like to see what the difference is of doing it like the Scots do, you know, doing that little ratio and seeing if that changes the spirit at all. And then also, you know, the things that I've learned about the history of Pennsylvania rye, where, you know, some of the distillers actually toasted their unmalted grain. Imagine the flavor that would have given. You know, they had to have understood peat, that they wanted a smoky characteristic to the whiskey. So to do that, no one's doing that. That'd be interesting to see. All I'm saying here is that history and, you know, what's going on in Scotland and what's going on in other countries, we can all borrow bits and pieces of that and create vast variations across the industry, if we choose.
No, I think that what you're saying is exciting when you build. Look, the distilleries today, and they're just trying to get things out, make a name, get established. And right. I think a lot, look, some of them don't know. Some of them don't have that experience, that knowledge. Look, you're like a sponge. You're going in there, you're asking to see worms, you're asking to understand how fine they're milling their grain to.
Right.
And when you start to probably talk to these distillers, they've got this point where, yeah, maybe they can start taking a left turn and playing around with some things and doing these limited release things that you never know could become their signature brand when they see the response or they see the result of what they're distilling. That's a possibility.
Well, it's the beauty of distillers too. They're such interesting people. They have a vision, obviously, to create what they set out to create, but they're constantly inundated with information from the industry as well. And they, like sponges, take it all in. I've talked to many distillers just through our conversations where they've gone, oh, I never thought of that. Let me try that. And so all of a sudden they're off running, you know, doing something else. I always, you know, it makes me feel wonderful to have. I'm not a distiller myself. I don't make the stuff myself, but I do get to, you know, share the things that I know and influence people in that way, which is just thrilling. So, especially with distillers I work with in Pennsylvania, because that's so close to my heart. But to tell them, you know, why don't you try rose and rye? Or, you know, why don't you try milling it with a stone mill instead of with the hammer mill and see how that affects the spirit?
Every opportunity to where you start with the grain, you talked about the water, you talked about the yeast, you even talk about the ferment, you know, we haven't talked about it, but the style of the fermenter, the shape of the fermenter, you know, are you, you know, is it a sour mash? Now we talk about barrels, you know, we talk about entrance proof, and the list of opportunity is endless when you start playing around. That's why no one's afraid to share their mash bill. Some people may not want to tell you about their yeast. You know, like it's 53% corn and I throw wheat in there. I throw some rye in there. I throw some barley in there. You can have the same mash bill. You're not going to make the same product unless on the same, you know, then we talk about the still.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your setup. What are you doing? It's the you're never going to recreate it. That, you know, Coke is the only one that doesn't want to give away their secret.
Yeah, I have yet to meet a distiller that was secretive, honestly. When I ask them questions, they're very open and share pretty much everything. I don't usually share, you know, stuff that they tell me just because, you know, I want to be respectful of the things they share. But I don't think I've ever really had pushback from anyone in that way where they're like, oh, I'm not going to tell you that. They know that I'm not trying to compete with them. So
Brewskits. Beer, grain, dog bones, brewskits. Your dog will go wild, brewskits. Beer, grain, dog bones, a healthy alternative for your pup.
Brewskits are all natural and made in the USA. Visit brewskit.com. That's BREWSCUIT.com.
We sent you that one unnamed, the label. of that first one. Any idea what that is? Or any idea? Give me some at least. I mean, I know you're not going to know exactly. Maybe you might pick it out. I don't know.
No, I don't think I'll be able to pick it out. But I can tell you, I mean, the fruit characteristic in it reminds me of a rye, but it might be a high rye. I mean, it's a little hot, but it's very soft. The finish on it has a lovely kind of like graham cracker, vanilla. It's got a good mouthfeel to it. Real nice and creamy, real round. Not real old, you know? But that would shock me if you told me it was. It doesn't taste old. I don't know. The honey note at the end is just nice. It's lovely. Yeah, so what are we drinking?
All right, so I wanted to welcome you back with a rye. And I thought I'd do a little Uncle Nearest rye because I figured you hadn't had it yet.
I haven't. Yes, thank you.
Okay, there you go. I found something maybe you haven't had. 100 proof. And one of the blessings of this is our friend Scott Wishart of Scott's Mini Woodshop brought this over and bequeathed this to us. We had this at an Uncle Nearest tasting at Roger Wilco. And he insisted we should have this. The funny thing is he hasn't finished his bottle yet. So it's one of the few bottles in my house he hasn't come over and finished. So, yeah. I mean,
cool.
So he made sure we had a little bit here for us to share. So I like this. It's the rye. When you taste a lot of the expressions, I was a fan in the beginning of Uncle Nearest, but to see what they're doing and how they're getting better and better, they had a single barrel limited release that they brought. And I'm like, that's the one, you can't have that. Sorry. You know, so, but it's delicious. And I wanted to make sure, like I said, I want to make sure you had a rye coming back to start with, because all that whiskey, you know, you got to clean your palate right now. We got to wash out your palate.
I did get a bunch of people giving me guff because they were like, wait, what are you doing going to Scotland? Like, you're a rye person. And I was like, you don't understand how similar it is to rye. Going to Scotland is really just bolstering my understanding of rye whiskey and how it was made. So, you know, give me crap all you like.
All right,
I was
that's fine.
There doing rye, whether they knew it or not.
We talk about rye with the Delaware Valley Fields Foundation and the Seed Spark Project. What's going on? I mean, I know right now it's the winter time. Everything's a little sleepy, but what's going on with the project and everything that you're doing?
Oh, onward and upward. It's just expanded. Bringing on a very large distiller like Iron City Distilling in Pittsburgh, or outside of Pittsburgh, actually, is a huge benefit to the project, because they are going to need, you know, millions of pounds of this, not just, you know, tens of thousands. So we can't expand, or I refuse to expand, without knowing that every ounce of rye that we grow has a home. There's no sense in us having surplus grain laying around. And I want to make sure that it's all utilized by Pennsylvania's distillers, so that, you know, all of this excellent whiskey being made from Rosin is always going to be associated with Pennsylvania rye makers. It's gone into bourbon, and yes, it has gone down to Mount Vernon and been made into whiskey there. That's now reaching 2 years old. It is officially 2 years old now. It turned two in December. So that's a straight whiskey, that Rosin. Two different types, actually. It was made with two different types of corn, because George Washington's rye does have corn in it. It's made at Stolen Wolf, obviously. Stolen Wolf will have a bottled and bond this September, as will Liberty Pole, which is going to be having their four-year-old soon, too. They sent me a little sample of the three-year-old fairly recently. Well, maybe not. Maybe more like 6 months ago, but still. It was absolutely wonderful. I cannot wait until that comes out. That's going to be a big boon to them. And thank you for sharing the Uncle Nearest, though. That was actually, that's definitely a surprise to me. I wasn't expecting it to.
Well, we'll see what you have to say about number two.
Have as much fruit.
We'll see what you have
to say. Oh, we're on to number two now?
Well, I mean, we can still talk. I just, you know, figured at some point you may want to pour another one.
Pardon the interruption. Thank you so much for listening to Fermented Adventure, the podcast. Could you do us a favor? Hit that follow button. It makes it easier for others to find us, and it helps us climb in the rankings. Take a screenshot of the podcast, post it, tag us, and let everyone know that you listen to the Fermented Adventure podcast. Now, back to our podcast.
Iron City, you mentioned. How many distilleries in Pennsylvania are now utilizing rose and rye?
I would, off the top of my head, I want to say 8 to 10.
Okay.
They're, you know, smaller distillers that are using it experimentally just to kind of test it out. But really, everything about rosin to me, we've always driven rosin toward being a core product for a distillery. That, you know, we don't want people just, you know, futzing around with it. Let's make it work. Let's make you carry this product going forward. And in doing so, partner with a farmer and support your local, you know, agricultural neighbors, you know, bolster the supply chain in Pennsylvania, all those wonderful little things.
Anyone that in Pennsylvania that is interested in distilling with rose and rye and is curious as to what they can produce from that, reach out and and make that happen. What I would say is the other part about the conversation is how many farmers now are producing and growing rose and rye?
The number actually shrank slightly this year, not because what happened this year is because of bringing on these larger distilleries, we really needed to focus on picking the places that grew the best and ramping up production in those areas. One of the greatest soil, well, best plots of land really in the country is in Lancaster County. And Stolen Wolf is blessed to have a family farm that's, you know, God was granted to them or deeded to them by William Penn's son, I think, you know, this century farm. In the 1600s, I think it was like the 1680s or something, this old, beautiful farm is growing their rose and rye for them. And their yield this year was through the roof. It was stellar how well they did. Unbelievably so, you know, to the point where it was competing with hybrid rye in their yields. That was a shock to me. But it's also establishing itself there, becoming more comfortable. They're replanting in every year. So they're going to be creating terroir in their whiskey with rosin, because that rosin will be slightly different than the rosin grown in the western part of the state with its different limestone soils. And Bob McDonald now has created an LLC with his Dancing Star Farms and is bringing on other neighboring farms to grow for him as well. So there's not just one farm growing rosin rye for Dancing Star Farms. There's more like four. So that's still under the umbrella of Dancing Star Farms. So even though the names of the farms necessarily isn't expanding, the amount of acreage is by quite a lot. So, you know, hundreds of acres as opposed to just, you know, several here and there little pockets. So
what is exciting and thrilling is hearing that from one seed, a handful of seeds, magic beans, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
But from a handful to now acreages and consigning other farmland to be under the umbrella of rose and rye. And to talk about Stolen Wolf being able to say, you know what? We are the distillery and this is our land and this is our rye. And then you have other producers that are saying, we need more land because we need to produce more, because there's more of a desire, there's more of a need for this. What it's doing for farming in a world where farming is under attack. You know, don't raise those cows because they belch and burp and meat's supposed to be bad for you. So what are these farmers going to turn to? This is a stable crop. This is something that if the weather gods are nice, as you say, booming crop, The reality is, it's a money producer for them. It's not scratching their head going, what can we grow this year so that we can keep our farm and stay viable?
Well, it's a difficult thing, too, because, I mean, we've had this conversation before where I've explained how, you know, farmers don't jump at this. This isn't exactly something that they're ready to, you know, oh, give me some of that rosin, I'm ready. Like, it never happens that way. It takes a lot to convince a farmer to change what he's used to growing, or she. So, you know, it's a definite uphill battle. But the great thing about Bob McDonald's situation is his neighbors can see his success by, you know, just talking to him and by looking at his farm and by seeing how he's doing, watching the expansion take place on his property. It's almost unrecognizable, that place now. Geico, he's got more bins and more, you know, machinery and more, like, you know, he has to bring in and hire combines now because his combine can't handle the amount of acreage that he's planting. So he brings in this giant, you know, combine from, I think it's out of state even, to come in and harvest so that, cause I mean, you can't harvest fast enough, with rye because when it does finally, dry and get to the moisture content you want out in the field, you can't wait for it to rain. You got to get out there and, you know, get that field cleared, almost immediately so that you don't end up having to wait another week or 2 weeks for it to dry out again. And, you know, anybody that lives in Pennsylvania knows that summer season is not exactly, you never know what's going to happen.
No,
so you,
you
really
don't.
Do
it could end abruptly. It could be very rainy. It could be dry. There's a lot of variables that they have to contend with. But you said something very important there. And I think we've reached that tipping point where you know, it's like nobody wants to be the first to take the arrows. And now that somebody can come back and say, look, we're making money. It's a viable project. People want it. We need more acreage. It's easier for these farmers now to say, get me the seed, get me whatever I need. I'm planting this and bring in the big combine. We'll harvest it. And it becomes a reality now. And what's going to happen is we talked about it. They can sell it. Distilleries are going to make it. I am quite sure that there are distilleries right now that are in conversation to try to bring this rye on. And I know we've talked about it. And I think I've mentioned or had a conversation with Bob McDonald about that, that there are distilleries out of state that want this. And he's had to tell them no.
No, it's one of the things that, you know, we don't mind doing if a distiller out of state wants the grain. It just has to be milled because we can't allow the seed to leave the state and be planted elsewhere until it is firmly established as a Pennsylvania crop, which takes some doing. And with the amount of advertising and marketing that we've had around the grain, you get a lot of attention. A lot of people are reaching out to Bob. What they don't realize is that the seed doesn't necessarily belong to Bob. It belongs to the Delaware Valley Fields Foundation and is still under the experimental it's still part of the experiment of the SeedSpark project. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we understand the best circumstances with which to grow this rye. And it's been a constant learning experience. You know, when does it need to go in? When is it too late? When is it too early? What's that sweet spot for planting? All this stuff gets recorded. I give, you know, pretty long questionnaires at the end of every season for all the farmers that are growing it to answer so that I can kind of compare notes from year to year and see, you know, where do we need to tweak it? What types of chemicals do we need to use? When do we need to spray? You know, when do we need to spray for fungicide or with fungicide? All these things are a big concern because ultimately we need yield. We need higher yields and you need to get everything right in the beginning for it to work in the end. Weather and everything else kind of adding to the problem later. But, you know, if you don't get it strong and you don't get it in the ground at the right time, you end up dropping your yields. So, you know, we're learning quite a bit. And the more information that I can gather, the more I can hand to every farmer in Pennsylvania that wants to grow the stuff so that they're not, you know, shooting darts, that they know exactly what to do in order to get the best possible crop they can get. So,
as a consumer, as a drinker, as somebody that just loves what's going on, This is a reason why, you know, we talked about in the beginning that Pennsylvania does have a place of discussion in the whiskey world.
Oh, that, absolutely.
Yes, I know they're the big players in Indiana and Kentucky and Tennessee. And, you know, we just enjoyed an Uncle Nearest. But don't sleep on Pennsylvania. And I'm not leaving anybody out, but it's because of this unique grain that you want to come here and you want to leave your home and say, you know what, I'm going to take a little tour. I'm going to start in the western part of Pennsylvania. Look, it's a 6-hour drive from Pittsburgh to Philly. You can hit quite a number of distilleries in between. Take a break. There's some great breweries and they're producing other things and you got great food. And so it's like this trail that you can really enjoy things you all never have, haven't had. And if you want to be well-rounded, right, you want to have that well-rounded experience. Like you talked about, you went to Scotland and you're getting Armagnac finishes and, you know, but that's the thing that we get exposed now to all these people. They're doing something slightly different. And when I have something that's why I love craft, because I'm going to have something that nobody else is doing. Nobody else can replicate. And it makes for just, you know, sitting around a fire, sitting around with friends, wherever you want to be. Making a cocktail is such an enjoyable experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Pennsylvania I've been traveling the state for the Seeds Bark Project since around 2015, possibly even before that, but I really started doing it in a highly organized way in 2016, where I started trekking the state. And making, you know, it was like a 13-hour drive for me from Philadelphia to Western Pennsylvania to out to Pittsburgh.
Well, because I would stop along the way. Speeding tickets you got along the way slows you down.
Well, I had to stop. I made my stops. So I made very highly organized plans as to how I would hit as many things, mills, farms, you know, anybody within the grain supply chain, a malt house, if you know, they existed at the time. Where I could find them, distilleries, obviously. I left out breweries, but you know, I focused on the vineyards that were doing a little distilling, making cognacs and brandies and things like that as well. So I got to see at least 45 distilleries inside the state of Pennsylvania.
What are we, 87 or 78 now? Am I just opposing?
It's over 100.
Is it over 100?
Well, they're not all producing rye, and they're not all making whiskey. So when you're talking about distilleries, you're talking about everybody.
Yeah, you know, I guess I was wondering, like the whiskey producers, I don't know if it's up to 100 for whiskey producers.
No, I don't believe it is.
Right. And no, there's some are closed that are just consigning stuff and
exactly.
That kind of, yeah.
So and maybe they have a still that's active as far as the government's concerned, but they're not actually making any spirit on it right now.
Right.
A lot of the times that's the case. But yeah, I think right around in the high 70s, 80s is where the number of whiskey makers are. So there's quite a few. I've been to about half of them, like I said, and man, there's so many more that I want to see, especially the new ones coming on board. It's also interesting what they're all doing. But for me, it was to find out more about their processes. I was interested in seeing who they were sourcing their grain from, how they were making their whiskey, what the process was, what other spirits were they making, all that stuff. I have just huge amounts of copious notes on every single distillery from when they started. And I've watched them over the years go from brand new distilleries, not quite knowing what they're doing, to coming into their own and becoming like seasoned veterans of the trade now. And, you know, to see what happened at Liberty Pole, my God, we were talking about this before, to have that incredible rack house and to have, you know, their brand new, beautiful building. It's stunning to see their success and to be there to witness it. Because I remember going in and looking at the, you know, the brand new space that they opened on Washington in Washington. And I remember like, you know, the chain in the back that he was showing me and the brand new Trident still that he had put in and, you know, how they were going to bring everything in. And I went down in the basement where they were milling in the basement and, you know, they had maybe 5 barrels on a shelf and they were brand new. And now to see them And the following that they have in Pittsburgh and in the western part of the state is just stunning. They're, the lines that they get around the block, you know, it's just, it, it, you can't help but smile about these things to see Pennsylvania grow in that way. It's just, it's great.
All right, so I gave you one other sample. You want to you want to venture off into what your experience is with that sample?
This one's a bourbon. It's got to be. It's too dry. It's got some fruit to it, though. Ooh, that's sweet. Ooh. Oh, that's really sweet.
And it's funny coming off the rye. So it's your palate has a different expectation, right?
And to be honest with you, the fact that the first rye, it's very nice. Don't get me wrong, but it is nothing compared to. Oh man, that is a heavy whiskey. I have legs on that. Anyway, that the rye, you can definitely tell that it's a column still rye. That it's a lot of the character in that rye came from the barrel, not necessarily from the rye itself. Rye is incredibly fruity, and you can taste the fruit in the Uncle Nearest, most definitely, but it's subtle. It's not that bang in the face character that old school rye had. Do you know what I mean? Yep. Real heavy, syrupy almost fruit character that the old ones had. The new ones are just so light and, you know, ethereal. I want bigger, bigger, you know, boom in my rye. So, yeah, but am I right that it's a bourbon?
You are right. You want to guess a state since I took you out of Pennsylvania for the first one?
It's got a great long finish to it. This isn't that Hidden Barn stuff, is it?
No.
No? What is it?
Okay.
It's
so go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want it. I mean, unless you want me to keep waxing on.
No, you keep nosing and tasting. It's just a wonderful thing to watch.
No, it's got a beautiful, there's like this stone fruit character to it, but it's real oily, which is nice. So many bourbons are not. That's why I'm leaning toward this being a craft distiller and not one of the bigger distillers, because it's got a, unless it's old, which I doubt. I don't know.
Mm. Do you have any guess on the state?
Syrupy. No. I have no idea. What am I drinking here?
All right. So we were out at Liberty Pole for their grand opening.
Shut up. This is Liberty Pole?
This is Liberty Pole. And this was what they had. This is a high rye bourbon whiskey. It's 113.1 proof. And this is Pennsylvania straight bourbon whiskey. And what we talked about is
the
when you
banger,
drink,
guys, wow. Right,
when you drink this, this is what I'm saying. Mm. Pennsylvania has come of age. This is something that you would put up against a lot of things out there in the world that people are paying way too much for because they're paying for a label. And once you venture out into different places of the world, you will find and see that I know you went on about the family, you know, the Huff family and Liberty Pole and stuff like that. Kudos to them. This was, when you see what they're doing with the Rick House, when you see what they're doing with their pot still and their production, you know, this is an example of this is one of the examples.
How about that segue, huh?
of Pennsylvania's finest. And
yeah.
And that's why I wanted to share that, because I know you haven't had it. And this is my complaint right now. If I can have it, a complaint department with Liberty Pole and a lot of the other distilleries too, because they're building, they're providing, because they have such limited releases.
Right.
You can't get them all.
And no,
we're all missing out on stuff except for them, because they're distilling it and hoarding it.
Well, that's why you go and visit them and you say, "Hi, Jim."
Yeah, you visit them.
Visit. Pour me something good.
Yeah, eight weeks ago, you just released something that was sold out in an hour. And
They don't have it. That's the thing about the distillers too. Like they, I remember Steve Beam telling me that. Like it's like, well, yeah, I make the stuff, but I don't keep it. I don't have any of these bottles. They're all gone. Like, I have maybe a sample of it or something, but once I've drank mine, it's all gone, which makes me sad, really. Like, if you're the guy making it, you should be able to have some of it for yourself.
I'm still not buying all of that, because I know that if it's something that he would fall in love with, there'd be a bottle somewhere that would be put aside. There's got to be,
but
right?
Then you drink it, right? Or you share it with a friend, and then it's gone, and then you never get it again.
Right.
But that's why you're a distiller, so you can make new ones.
Yeah, you don't just sell it all. I mean, you keep some of that back. You have to. Look, this is why I love doing Whiskey Tangents with Laura Fields. I love sharing and talking whiskey. One of these days, we'll do a summertime episode where we'll sit and you'll smoke cigars and wax on about your love for cigars and tea and and all the, you are,
I picked those up
so
in Europe
layers.
Too.
There's so many layers to you. but one of the things that I know that I can't wait for, we see all your research that you're doing about whiskey history, about American whiskey history, about being a steward for specifically Pennsylvania rye. I know you have a book coming out soon at some point down the road. When is there a date or an opportunity we can expect to see Laura's first published book?
Not yet. And believe me, I've got plenty of people hounding me about it. It's something that I've been working on for so long. And it's a difficult thing, as any researcher knows, to study something that no one else has written about, because you have no books to reference. You have no one to really look to teach you. You're learning on your own. And a lot of the things that I've learned in the people that I've met, some of the things that I'd written 5 years ago, I've learned more about, and so I keep going back and tweaking it. It's hard to know when enough is enough and just to put it out there, you know? And that's one of the things that I keep being hounded about. Like, just put it out. And I'm like, well, I would love to do that, but you have to understand that I've written about 200 unique distilleries. These unique distillery histories are pretty, there's a lot. There's a lot of pages, let's put it that way. And a lot of images and a lot of information, and I don't want to bang it up. So I'm really trying to go back and proofread everything and make sure that the things that I've written are accurate. And so when I first started writing the book years ago, I started writing only up until Prohibition, because my initial intention was only to write right up until 1920 and give the history of the pre-pro distillery. But then, as time went on, it occurred to me that the things that people relate to about rye whiskey are from post-prohibition. So for a person to read it without any, you know, anchor for themselves, like, I can't write about Old Overholt and not write about Old Overholt that we know today. You know what I mean? Like I got to get it. I got to at least get you to Jim Beam. So then it became, well, how far do I want to take these distillers? Because there were about 42 distilleries left in Pennsylvania in the 30s. So there's quite a few of those stories go on past 1920. And then it became, well, now I'm writing about Prohibition, which is an impossible topic, to cover, especially when you're talking about unique distilleries, which is where I always wanted the book to focus. I want to make sure that I'm being respectful to the families, to the distillers themselves, to the history of these unique distilleries. I don't want to make this a book about the history of Pennsylvania rye. I want to make it a history of these individuals, which is the important thing to me, because everything to me about distilling and whiskey speaks to people and those stories. I don't want to do them a disservice, let's put it that way. So going back and making sure that all of those families are respected. And then I keep meeting people who know somebody who, you know, or they're from that town, and I'll find somebody on Facebook who collects bottles from that particular era. And so, you know, I'll reach out to them, and that sort of changes my story. You can see what I'm getting at here. It's a lot.
I do. And one of the, look, here's the thing. I'm just an observer. Right. I'm just a pedestrian through this time in history where whiskey and craft is, and bourbon and all the things that are happening. I'm just, here I am. And the more I learn, the more I want to learn. But at some point, right, you got to start working on volume two.
No, you're right. No, you're absolutely right. It is true that I do need to get it out there. I just don't want it, you know, I want it to be good. I want it to be right. And I want all of the distillers in Pennsylvania to be able to put it on their shelves and be proud. I also want it to help with what you talked about before, the idea of tourism. There are still ruins of these old distilleries. There are still locations in Pennsylvania where the person who owns a house doesn't realize they're living in a distillery. There's still, you know, there's a lot of ignorance in the towns that are named after distilleries or after distillers themselves. The people don't know it, that there was ever a distillery there to begin with. I've had conversations with people on ancestry.com who, you know, I'll reach out to because I'm like, you have some information on your timeline. I was hoping that you might be able to share some photographs with me, things like that. And they're like, oh no, my ancestor was never a distiller. I'm like, oh no, I beg to differ. Here's the information that I found. I'm happy to share anything. And then all of a sudden there's this kind of light bulb and that changes their perspective on the history of their family. And a lot of people in Pennsylvania don't like the fact that their family has a history of rye, which is an unfortunate side note that Prohibition, you know, had on Pennsylvania.
And it still echoes today, right?
I mean, so much, yeah.
You know, even into the grain aspect of things. 100 years, you know, into the Prohibition era and then post-Prohibition, let it go. I mean, but there's still something that family DNA, it's still irksome. It's still, they don't want to identify. We had Camille, Sewanee Spirits, who is creating this wonderful Carolina gold rice. It's a whiskey. Sewanee Spirits.
Right. Yeah. David Shields, baby. Yeah.
And what she discovered was, you know, she has history in her family of distilleries and speakeasies and stuff like that. That she didn't even know about until she became interested in this product or the rice itself and what she could produce. And I'll tell you what, it's delicious. It's so unique. It's like a shochu and a sake and a whiskey. And if they all birth together, this is what they produced. But that's the wonderful thing about, you know, when you start to learn the history and you start to scratch and I just rely on you because, you know, look, you teach me stuff. You teach us things. Can't wait to see the book so I can do some beach reading.
Right. There might be some disappointments in the, there might be some disappointments in the book for people as well, because the truth about Monongahela rye is very different than what most people understand. You know, I was just talking to a distiller earlier today about the history of rye whiskey making in Pennsylvania. And, you know, he was like, well, column stills, you know, most people make rye on column stills. Isn't that part of Pennsylvania tradition? And I had to say, no, not at all. And never. Pennsylvania rye whiskey, when it was made in the state of Pennsylvania, there was one column still in the state. And that was after 1900. And it was outside interests. And it wasn't in the western part of the state. It was in the east. District 12, I believe. So one... You know what I'm saying? Like, it was not a Pennsylvania tradition to have a column still. Now, that does not mean that it wasn't. That's historically speaking. Column stills came into Pennsylvania after Prohibition. So it is historically accurate to have a column still in Pennsylvania. It's just not a Monongahela rye thing. Do you know what I mean? It's a more modern era style of rye whiskey, and it's the column stills weren't used the same way as they are in Kentucky. There was a lot more refined, lower proof spirit coming off of those columns. It's just a different manipulation of the spirit.
See, this is where we go back to your trip to Scotland, because those Scotland, that came from Scotland, they didn't know column stills; they knew pot stills, right? That's what they distilled on. That's where that whole history begins here in Pennsylvania and the Americas.
And it's not as if he asked me too. He goes, well, wouldn't they have embraced the column after? No, like even after the Kentucky completely embraced the column. Absolutely. It was almost like, you know, think about Kentucky as lowland Pennsylvania, like lowland America. You know what I mean? And the highlands of Pennsylvania, we never never did. It was always the pot still or the three chamber still. And most of them were chamber stills of varying degrees. It wasn't all three chambers, folks. There were also two chambers and five chambers and all different types of technology that went into creating these stills. But they were chamber stills, not columns, not coffee stills, not that at all. But all
right, so the way yeah. we're not, and I'm going to leave it at but, because the way we're going to do this is because just like your book, just like mm-hmm. that movie, tune mm-hmm. in next time when we'll finish that but, or we just may go off on another tangent. But here's what I know, Laura. I mean, every time we sit down, the knowledge, the information, the experience, what's going on in Pennsylvania and the rye, what you bestow, it's magical. I love it. This is my way of absorbing knowledge and learning things, and hopefully the listener takes that away too. So tune in next time for another episode of Whiskey Tangents with Laura Fields. By that time, she may have a book out. You don't know. Or you never know what she's going to be doing. Laura, thanks so much. I can't wait to see and hear and look at some other things you're doing on social media. Where can people find you on social media?
Yes, please reach out to me on social media. I'm happy to share information, even if the book isn't out. If you're curious about the history of Pennsylvania or you have specific questions, you can find me on Facebook. I'm Laura Patrizio, actually, on Facebook. My husband's last name, I kept my name, Laura Fields. But the site with all the history information is actually facebook.com/American Whiskey History. And that's where I put all my posts up pertaining to American whiskey history, mostly rye. Obviously I'm a little biased, but you know, recently I have been going over the Scotland trip and things that I learned there. So yeah, that's a great place to find me. You can also go to seedsparkproject.com and find out where all the locations are where the grain is being grown, find out all of our partners, find out information about them. That is where you will find all the distillers that are participating in the project as well. And anything else you want to know, you can contact me through that page as well.
I know you're recovering from jet lag. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tonight, enjoy some more whiskey, and we will talk soon.
Thank you, Rich. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Laura.
Cheers.
Cheers.